The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. A sunny Thursday here in Southern California. A little bit later, we're going to be calling Mark Titus from Grantland.com, who wrote a really, really good Greg Oden feature yesterday that went up. That got a lot of attention. We're going to talk to him about the piece, whether Greg Oden read it, all that stuff. And then I think at the tail end, I haven't told my dad we're calling, but I think we're going to call him because it's Game 6 Celtics-Hawks tonight, and he's freaking out. So there's been some referee news for that game that's not going to make him happy. So we're going to call him at the end. But right now, our buddy Jack O, diehard Yankee fan, their Mariano Rivera replacement closer, blew last night's game. We're going to check in, see how he's feeling. Let's give him a ring.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Ah, Johnny.
What's up, buddy?
How you feeling?
Well, that was a rough one last night. That was a rough one. You know, it's D-Rob, David Robertson's trial by fire. And, you know, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. He's not Mariano, so it's a learning process. That's what I'm telling myself.
When was the last time a Yankee closer apologized on Twitter for his performance? Was it in the late 80s was the last time that happened? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think the last time it happened, actually, the closer apologized by telegraph. It was that long ago. So.
Yeah, I have note to all the athletes out there. Not a good idea to acknowledge how bad you were on Twitter.
No, that's not a good sign. I didn't realize you did that, so that's troubling.
Yeah.
When you're a closer, you're supposed to have ice in your veins, you know? Sometimes you blow a save, you just got to get right back on the horse tomorrow. And I don't like the fact he's apologizing. That means it's in his head. That's not good. I'm troubled by that.
J.R. Smith of the Knicks, who sucked in round one, did the same thing yesterday. He must have went and read his Twitter replies because he tweeted something like, "All you haters who want me out of New York, you might get your wish," because he's a free agent.
Oh,
he's like, "Settle down, J.R."
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's not helping. No upside for that tweet. What are people going to be like, "Oh, we better lay off J.R. Smith now. He might leave after shot 20% round one."
Don't want to run him out of town.
Yeah. So walk me through the Robertson.
He's come in as the
nervous
two games now. Today's Thursday.
Yeah.
Tuesday night, he actually got the save. I think that he got a save. He pitched three times since Mariano's been hurt. But against Kansas City, it was not a save situation. He got a save the other night, but he put a couple guys on base because he did that in the eighth inning too. I mean, he's like, I think they call him Houdini. He's like a magician, but he has to be a magician because he gets himself into trouble. It's kind of like if he sawed himself in half, but he was the one with the saw. He puts the guys on base and then he's able usually to put the fire out. He did that the other night, but then last night he was just terrible. He put the first guy on, he put the second guy on, loaded the bases. And then he actually pitched well. He loaded the bases, and Carlos Pena came up. And I'm like, well, this is all she wrote. Struck out Carlos Pena on a nasty pitch. He threw some great strikes to Carlos Pena, like right on the black, right on the corner. I'm like, whoa, but get out of this. Then you're looking for a double play. B.J. Upton hits a sacrifice fly to tie the game. And you're like, all right, okay, 1-1. You know, maybe he can get out of this now. Matt Joyce, he got two strikes on Matt Joyce. I was feeling good. Like, all right, we'll go to the ninth, tied. And then threw a meatball down the plate that Matt Joyce hurt himself on somehow and still hit his hit out of the park. So
he hurt himself as he hit it out of the park?
Yeah, he was swinging, and I don't know what – I didn't see anything about the game after the fact to see if he was hurt, but he, like, limped around the bases. It was Kirk Gibson-esque. I don't know if he twisted his ankle on the swing or he hurt his knee or something. It looked kind of bad. Michael Kay during the game was like, "Oh, he's smile. I got a big smile on his face that home run." And it was actually a grimace of pain because he could barely get around the bases.
That's funny. In Michael Kay's defense, he's Michael Kay.
True. It was late in the game. He was bummed out about the 3-run homer. So yeah. So then it was four. That gave up 4 runs in the ninth, and then that was all she wrote.
Yeah, the Rays are threatening to pull away here.
That was a big win for the. That would have been a big win for the Yankees there to, if they could have won a 1-0 game. That would have been a big confidence booster for Robertson, and then you know it puts them right back in the race. That's a huge swing right there. It's only Manny, you can't go crazy, but that would have been a nice win.
Speaking of confidence boosters and people who should apologize to their fans on Twitter, Mark Teixeira.
Oh my God. Oh my. I mean, well that's what really. I always find a way to blame these things on Mark Teixeira. It makes me feel better. He's my whipping boy. And he came up in the eighth inning when the Yankees had a 1-0 lead, and it was first and second and one out, and he promptly grounds into a double play. Classic Teixeira. Just classic. I mean, if Robertson has a bigger cushion there, if he could, God forbid, hit a home run and it's 4-0, I mean, it's a big cushion for Robertson there. Maybe he's not walking the tightrope, feels a little better. But, of course, he freaking grounds into a double play. I think he's hitting like 215 now, 219, something like that. Under 220, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
I think he has. I saw last time. I think he has 4 home runs and a ridiculously low number of RBIs. Everybody's all over Adrian Gonzalez for the Red Sox because of his power numbers. But they should thank their lucky stars that they didn't get locked into Teixeira in that contract.
Yeah, Adrian Gonzalez is just getting crushed back home.
I was trying to think this morning. I was thinking about Teixeira because a guy sent me a funny tweet that I retweeted and. John Sterling, the Yankees radio guy, his home run call for Teixeira is a text message to write. And so he said he thinks a text message should really be when somebody grounds out to end the inning. That should be known heretofore as a text message. Right. I was thinking about Teixeira. For the money he makes, I can't think of a Yankee who's been worse in the last 25 years when you factor in his contract.
Holy mackerel.
It's terrible.
I feel like I should have a counter, but... So last 25 years, so you're going back to 1987.
I mean, the Yankees have had disappointing players over the years.
What about
Winfield
a Robin?
Never lived up to his contract. You know, any number of pitchers through the years, Randy Johnson, Kevin Brown. But for the amount of money, for an everyday player, for a guy who should be a middle-of-the-order thumper, making $18, $20 million a year, he is horrific. And every year it's the same thing, always a slow starter. Well, he starts slow, and then he's terrible in the postseason. So I don't care what he does against the Orioles in June.
Wow.
Worthless. Absolutely worthless.
So you
good
have...
Good father, though. Good family man. That's good. That's a good thing.
I could feel the sarcasm.
Yeah.
So this is year 4 for Teixeira.
Yeah.
Year 1, he 383 on base, 565 slugging, 39 homers, 122 RBI.
Got her money's worth that year.
Not terrible. Year 2, dropped down to the 365 on base, 41 slugging, 33 homers, 108 RBI.
Mm.
Now, the nerds say that RBI don't matter, but I like throwing it out there to give it some sort of context. Year 3, see another decline.
Yeah.
Down to 341 on base, 494 slugging, so under 500 slugging 2 years in a row, 39 homers, 111 RBI. What we're proving here is you're basically, if you're in the middle of that Yankee lineup, you're going to end up with 110 RBI every year.
Yeah, because guys are on base in front of you. And, I mean, if it's possible to have quiet home runs and quiet RBIs, he does.
Yeah.
I can't think of any he's had in big circumstances or big games. Now, let me have this caveat. When the Red Sox imploded a few weeks ago and they had the 9-0 lead, he had a huge game that day. He had 2 home runs and I forget how many RBIs. He was huge. He was all over every rally.
Yep.
I'll give him credit for that. And he finally did it against the Red Sox, who I think he was like 0 for 60 in his Yankee career. I could be off on the numbers, but he literally was like 2 for 40 or something against the Red Sox in the past few years, which is also the knock on Gonzalez that he doesn't do anything against the Yankees or the Rays. Same thing could be said for Teixeira against the Red Sox. So they had one good game against them, which was huge, and that helped to put the knife in the Red Sox back. So that was that can't be discounted for his service to Yankee universe on that one, but overall, I can't remember any big hits or big moments he's had, and certainly he's had none in the postseason. They've won in spite of him in 2009, and they've lost in other years he's been on the team in the postseason because of him.
So, Teixeira against the Red Sox from 2009, 2010, 2011, 210 at-bats, 361 on base, 500 slugging, 15 homers.
15?
Yeah.
What time frame?
You might have to recant that statement.
What time frame is this? Has he been a Yankee?
This is 09, 10, and 11. 15 homers.
Really?
210 at-bats, yeah.
You probably just so they these games.
No, they were probably, most of them were probably in.
Yeah, somebody was up a lot or, yeah.
In Tampa, against Tampa, he's hitting 229, 323 on base. These are the last 3 years. 188 at-bats, 9 homers. Tampa, probably a better test than the Red Sox.
What was his batting average against the Red Sox in the past 3 years?
248.
See.
He struck out, this is interesting. He struck out 56 times in 210
at-bats. Yeah, 200 at-bats.
Yeah.
So one out of every four.
In April,
those must 09, be more than the home runs.
April 09, 10, and 11, he hit 196, 351 on base, 383 slugging. And then, So, yeah, you're right. He's July in those 3 years, he was 299, 385, 538.
And I will never understand a guy. He always says, "Oh, I'm a slow starter. I'm slow, and I play poorly in April, and I don't really get my swing going until later." Well, if that was the case, and you're getting paid $20 million, and you know that's a factor, wouldn't you maybe alter your off-season routine? Maybe start swinging a bat in November instead of December, or whatever his routine is. Maybe alter things a little bit.
Here you go. This is going to back up what you said before. Teixeira in Fenway Park, 09, 2010, and 2011. 107 at-bats, 206 batting average.
There we go. That's what I'm thinking.
739 OPS, 5 homers, and 28 strikeouts.
There we go.
There you go. So you were like two-thirds right.
Yeah.
And he probably had some.
And there were big. There were some big strikeouts mixed in there. Guys on base.
I'll put it this way. I'm a Red Sox fan, and obviously the best people to judge the players on your own team are the players rooting against that team.
Yeah.
I'm never scared when Mark Teixeira comes up. I always feel like we can get him out. Always.
Yeah. That tells you all. That tells me everything I need to know right there.
Just probably how you feel the same way with Adrian Gonzalez.
Yeah. He doesn't put the fear of God into me either. I mean, Big Poppy scares the hell out of me.
Yes.
With good reason, because he kills
so
the Yankees.
So does Pedroia, right?
Yes, unfortunately. Yes. Pedroia and Big Poppy scare the hell out of me, but I have no fear about Kevin Youkilis about Adrian Gonzalez or really anybody else in that lineup.
Well, I don't think anyone fears Kevin Youkilis at this point.
True. Good point.
But, the Yankees that scare me, Jeter will always scare me. I don't care if he's, like, in a wheelchair with, like, his left arm in a swing. I'll still feel like he can get a hit. And,
Old timers day 2050, you're still going to be nervous.
Granderson scares me because he's such a wild card.
The Grandy man.
You just don't know what's going to happen from at bat with him. And then I got to say, A-Rod, I can't believe I'm saying this, but he kind of frightens me a little bit. I feel like the 09 World Series kind of.
He's had some moments against the Red Sox.
Yeah, he's had moments. He's killed us. He's quietly killed us for a couple years.
Years ago that went into the extra innings in the 15th inning or whatever when he hit it out. And he hit a big home run off Papelbon in the ninth a couple years ago. He's had some moments.
I'm going to look up his stats while we're talking. Yeah, so the Adrian Gonzalez thing's gotten really interesting because everyone's just so bitter about this Red Sox season.
Right.
And, there has to be scapegoats.
Right.
But the Bobby V thing got beaten into the ground in about 2 weeks. So then it's like, all right, who's next? So then you focus on Gonzalez, who's, they traded a lot for. They paid him a lot. He's supposed to be the best
Rizzo.
Guy in the team. Yeah, Rizzo. Rizzo has not come back to the Red Sox yet. But
I get tweets with updates about Rizzo. He's tearing it up in AAA this year, though. He could be up with the Cubs soon.
A-Rod is last 3 years, not counting this year. The 940 OPS, 12 homers, 33 RBI against the Red Sox. Not bad.
Yeah, he's been all right.
Not great. 8 stolen bases somehow.
I mean, his contract is just a, anvil around the necks of the Yankees, too. I mean, between he and Teixeira doing nothing in the middle of that lineup, it's a miracle they have a winning record at the moment.
Did we ever figure out why they gave him that contract?
Well, partly because, I think that was a Hank Steinbrenner deal, I think, that he wanted the flash of having A-Rod. And they seemed to think that they were going to have all these marketing tie-ins with A-Rod and his quest to beat Bond's home run record. And this was before the steroid thing, so he was going to do it clean. And they figured, it would be like a national celebration. there'd be a million different marketing tie-ins, so the contract would pay for itself. But a lot of things went wrong with that plan.
Yeah.
His decline, the steroids, the fact that, you know, he's going to have an asterisk if he does pass Bonds, too. So nobody cares about the home run thing anymore because it's also tainted. So there was it's not quite going to work out like they hoped.
Yeah, I think that's been the single strangest thing about what happened to baseball the last 15 years is that these benchmark numbers that we grew up with no longer really have any real meaning.
Like, no.
The 73 homers, you're never going to even have a conversation about that. And
no.
Then whatever Bonds, whatever his final home run number is, like, that doesn't feel right either. Like, it really feels like a 400 season, a 56-game hitting streak, 30 wins. Those are really the only ones. Are there any other records left that you would get legitimate? Like, I got excited when Josh Hamilton hit four homers. Like, to me, that was
cool.
Like, all right, that's cool. That's something that, you know, never happens. But, yeah, it's weird that those benchmark records.
Even, like, 500 home runs, that used to be a big deal, the 500 home run club and, you know, the select few guys that played, and now it's so devalued where, you know, all these guys are members of it now, but it's all so tainted that even that's not a big deal anymore.
Have you seen the Major League Baseball standings?
The standings?
Yeah. The Red Sox are, like, the third worst team in the league, like, in either league. They're the third worst team in baseball.
They just went 2-6 against the Orioles, the A's, and the Royals.
They're right. I'm loading right now. They are 7.5 games back from first place. They are 4 games ahead of the Twins, who have the worst team I think I've seen in like 5 years.
And the only reason they're ahead of them is because the Red Sox went into Minnesota and swept them a couple weeks ago.
They're 3 games ahead of San Diego, who completely gutted their team, and I think they spent like $5 on it this year.
Right.
And, I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, the Angels started coming back.
Yeah,
I don't know
bit.
If this Red Sox team can come back. Like, I don't even know if they can get to 500.
Well,
did you see Beckett story?
All you need to know about the Red Sox is when I read things on the Boston Globe or wherever, there's fans that are legitimately waiting for the return of Daisuke Matsuzaka. That's how far you've fallen.
What?
When the national treasure is viewed as a savior by people, I mean, do people forget how much they hated him and what a nibbler he was, and he only lasts till the fourth or fifth inning, and he's been brutal the last couple of years? People really believe that because Bobby V can speak Japanese that he's going to have some sort of mystical relationship with Daisuke and turn him into...
Yeah.
You know, Justin Verlander. I don't see myself, I don't think that's happening. But people really hope for that. So that tells you how far you've sunk.
Well, you know what else told me how far we sunk was that the like, really, Josh Beckett, you haven't done enough? now you're playing golf when you were hurt or whatever the hell happened. Like, come on. Can you go like a month without something, please?
It's really unbelievable. I mean, all the heat he took in the offseason as the perceived ringleader of the beer and chicken brigade,
right.
All the ink that was spilled about that and pixels and everything else, all the media that covered that, you would think he would be like, you know, I'm counted on to be the leader. I'm kind of the ace. I get paid a lot of money. I'm going to come back in great shape, and I'm going to be like, I'm going to be a model citizen and lead these guys to victory. Instead, he came back, and he just gives like one FU after another to the team and the fans. I mean, they need to just get him out of town. Even if they get 50 cents on the dollar, I think it's irretrievably broken, his relationship with Boston and the Red Sox.
I have a couple trades. I think – I don't remember if I talked about this with you or with Jonah. Euclid needs to go to the Dodgers. It's a good
the
trade
Dodgers?
For them. They could definitely use a corner infielder. He is in the final year of his contract. I think he needs to change his scenery. I'm not totally sold that he's done yet. He'll always be able to get on base and take pitches and do that whole thing. And
I heard on the radio the other day that there were reports, I forget where it was, either on ESPN Boston or the Boston Globe, about how the Red Sox are actively trying to trade him. And there were scouts that said that he has – there was 4 scouts that said, oh, yeah, teams would be all over him.
Right.
I was mystified by that.
Yeah, you could argue that he's a little physically banged up and that if he was playing first base. Well, if he was playing first base or DH, maybe
he'd – You have to trade him to an American League team, though, because he's going to, you know, he can't play the, he really shouldn't be in the field.
Well, he could be a first baseman. Come on, anyone can play first base. Mo Vaughn played first base, he had 300 pounds.
That's true.
The guy, though, I've always wondered why a National League team didn't go after Beckett, because he can hit.
Yeah.
Like, he'd be great in the National League.
I mean, he could, you know, he's capable. He just is sort of checked out, and the media watches his every move now. Yeah. I think he could still be a capable pitcher, though.
Like, if Houston's moving to the AL next year, that doesn't make sense. I was thinking, like, the Texas National League team, and then he could be in Texas. And
yeah.
He could do tobacco, you know, chew tobacco and hit, and be happy.
Go hunting.
Go hunting.
Stuff.
Play golf. Nobody would know. Like, right. Did anyone know you played golf in Houston? Not one person would know this.
we have no media that covers our team. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's all right. You're fine. Go play golf naked. Nobody's going to know. But, yeah, I think a National League team should acquire him. The fact that he's been in the American League these last few years has been a total waste. Because how many good hitting pitchers are there?
It's true.
I feel like when we have interleague games, I always am excited when he bats. Like, I feel like he's going to have a good hack.
It's like Sabathia. You know? Sabathia can hit.
So, Gonzalez, I think, is untradeable with his contract.
Right.
Not that they would anyway. I think they're kind of all in on him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the other one, I guess, who you could argue needs a change of scenery, although he also might just have to take him behind Fenway and put him down like a horse, is Buchholz.
Yeah.
Who I don't think enough has been made about how bad he's been. There's some
stat.
Well,
they were really – I mean, a lot of their offseason plans were on him counting on him being a frontline starter.
Yeah, it was supposed to be him, Lester, and Beckett.
Right. That's the big three, and then we'll muddle through with DuBrat and Bard or somebody else in the fifth spot. A lot was on Buchholz's shoulders, and he's been horrific. He's been terrible.
There was some stat – I think I read it in Buster's column – that since the dead ball era. I always like when the dead ball era is brought up.
Yes.
Dead ball era. I'm always in when the dead ball era is brought up as some sort of indicator. but I guess he's like, I'll probably get this wrong, but I'm in the ballpark of whatever it was. It was like him and one other guy in the past 76 years have had six starts of the season. They've given up five runs or more in each of the first six starts. And I was like, how's that possible? That's only happened twice?
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's only happened twice.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Fortunately, he was on my fantasy team. We benched him for four of those six starts because you could see from his first start, like, it was like, oh, this isn't good. Like, this is
what people forget is, I mean, the guy did break his back last year, which is a rare injury for a baseball player. I mean, the guy had a broken back. It's no joke. So I don't know if it's a case of coming back from that or being worried about really letting it loose because you don't want to break your back again. I'd be a little concerned by that myself.
He was also a guy that the advanced metric guys were pointing to as somebody that overachieved, considering his FIP and BABIP and all the things that you hate.
Yeah.
He was saying basically that whatever his stats were a little deceiving. So, of course, we ignored all that and spent $12 on him in our office.
He's our guy.
Yeah. So we have him for 12. He's basically – it's hard to say what was worse, actually. $23 for Rivera, $12 for Clay Buchholz. I don't know.
Wow.
It's a toss-up. At least Rivera gave us a month of decent
stats. Yeah, he got a little something.
But,
well,
yeah, it's
like,
bad.
Looking at the Red Sox, if you look at their roster, and, you know, everybody on the – I love to read the comments on, you know, when the Red Sox are imploding, nothing makes me happier, or listening to EEI as I drive home. And I don't know what the fix is. Their starting pitching is awful, and in terms of having tradable pieces to try and bring something back to have some hope, I mean, the guy they have to trade is Ellsbury, but he's hurt right now. He's probably the biggest trade chip you have, and you figure he's gone anyway when he's a free agent because Boris is going to go for the most money. So he's a trade chip.
I would take the draft picks.
What's that? Get the draft picks.
Here's the real problem with the Red Sox. Let's make some trades. Let's rebuild. But, like, who's doing the rebuilding? Is it the people who decided it was a good idea to trade Jed Lowry for Mark Melanson?
Right.
So we're going to put it in their hands? The people that didn't help, you know, Cody Ross was, like, the only decent thing that they did last winter.
Well, Ryan Sweeney's been pretty
good. Oh, yeah, you're right. Ryan, Yeah. All right.
He's been
so
a pleasant surprise for you. I don't know if he's going to keep it up, but he's been hitting well.
I'm bitter. I'm just lashing out.
I understand.
Now, the Lowry trade, which made no sense when it happened, because you could at least have made the case that Lowry, let's see what he does for a year when he's not injured, doesn't have a dumb injury or something.
He was the Will Middlebrooks of last April. Or May. He's what turned their season around.
Yeah.
Put the team on his back for 2 weeks early in the year, and then he was traded for Mark Melanson.
He's over 300 for the Stros.
Yeah.
He's their number two hitter right now.
I think the propaganda wing of the Red Sox claimed that he was too injury prone and they didn't like his long term future because of injuries. But I mean, you know, the guy was great when he played.
Quickly, Megan Draper.
Yes.
Wait, can we put her in the Pantheon yet?
She's pretty good. I was in on her after Zuby Zuby Zoo.
I think she's had a breakout year that rivals really anything we've seen on television.
You know, I just say this, and I don't want your friend John Hamm to be mad at me, and I'm no Lee Strasberg, but the woman who plays her, not a great actress.
Who?
Do you agree or disagree with that?
The woman who plays Megan Draper?
Yeah.
Oh, I think she's a great actress.
I don't think she's a very good actress. Do you?
I totally disagree.
Really?
Oh, vehemently. This is our biggest disagreement in like 10 years. I love Megan Draper.
I don't think she's very good. I don't ever know what emotions she's trying to convey to me.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't think she's a very good actress. I think she's pretty.
Megan Draper.
Attractive.
Oh,
I enjoy her work. I just don't think she's a very good actress.
It's a really hard
part. I think in real life
she
should go to some of those acting classes that her character's going to. I think in real life her character needs to lie on a floor while a teacher walks around.
I don't know if I'm emotionally ready for the 60s to make Don Draper's era obsolete and be a fossil.
That's what the whole season's been about. It's been crazy.
Like
a square now, like he's forcing his wife to eat sherbet at a Howard Johnson's. Doesn't relate to the music or the kids these days. It's crazy.
It's really depressing. Because, you know, like season six, it'll be 1968. He's going to awkwardly try to grow the sideburns. It's not going to work.
Exactly. The leisure suit. It's not going to end well for Don. He's just, you know, he used to be the coolest guy. And now he's like the least cool guy. It's crazy.
I'm making a trade with my dad. I'm going to watch Justified. I'm going to go backwards and catch up on the first three seasons. And he's
going
to watch Mad Men. It's pretty sad that I had to make a trade with my dad to convince him to watch Mad Men, which is only like one of the best three shows.
It's so right in his alley. It's crazy.
Like, I know. It's like, plus he was there for that era.
That's what I mean.
I'm like, really? I have to put a gun to your head and make you watch a show that's won four straight Emmys?
Why was he opposed to it?
Because he was intimidated by, he was really scarred by the whole Wire thing, which he loved, but he went to a dark place with The Wire. He was watching like two or three a day, and it was all he was tight. It like consumed him for like 3 weeks. And I don't think he wants to go to that place again. He's like happy retired guy. But
you'll like Justified.
Yeah, I like Justified. When the Celtics fall out of it, and he's staring at the 72 win Red Sox season.
Yeah, he needs some distractions.
That's about to happen. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah,
all right, Johnny.
Is great. Season two of Justified is part of the Pantheon. It was so good. You'll enjoy.
I can't wait for all the tweets you're going to get from people who are outraged that you're not in on Megan Draper.
I'm in on her I just don't think she's a great actress. I'm going to get a lot of tweets that agree with me, including from acting teachers.
I really want to know. Yeah, I want to know what the feedback is for that. Give us, how worried are you about the Yankees this week? Scale 1 to 10.
Still early yet. I'll go 3.5.
All right, for the Red Sox, scale of 1 to 10, I'm a 27.
Nice. That seems
actually,
about right.
No.
That might be a little low, actually.
It's low. I'm a 29.
That's better.
I'd rather see them bottom out and make some trades and try to get out of this catastrophe of a season.
But, Bill, their sellout, they don't want to put the sellout streak at risk. It's one of the most storied records in sports.
Yeah, last thing, and then we'll let you go. The fact that they play, first of all, this whole Sweet Caroline thing happened after I left. The Boston that I knew and loved would never have put up with the Sweet Caroline thing. But the fact that they play Sweet Caroline when the team is losing.
Yeah.
Might
the
be
best
my
thing
single...
ever was when they played it after they blew the 9-run lead to the Yankees that game.
It's just, it's so disappointing. Like, I don't understand how that can happen.
And people
it should only be played. It should only be played during a tie game or a win. Like, this is the kind of stuff that 10 years ago, like, Boston fans would have made fun of the other fans for. I don't know. Where's the support against this?
I like to think that there was some old, like, Southie-type guy, like a Johnny Most with a cigarette dangling off his lip, that was tempted to try to break into the, like, the PR area where they played that Sweet Caroline music and killed the guy that was playing the CD. I mean, where are the old guys? But see, those fans are all gone. It's all pink hats and... It's all, no, it's like going to a nightclub. It's all
true.
Fenway Park is. It's like a fancy, trendy bar.
Man, that's why I haven't been back in a couple of years.
Yankee Stadium is too, but it's a trendy bar you can't afford to get into. It's a trendy bar with too high of a cover.
Like, seriously, the Red Sox owners, everybody's kind of out on them right now. The best thing they could do is make an announcement that they only are going to play Sweet Caroline when it's either a tie game or the team's winning.
Absolutely.
People are like, oh, that's cool. Maybe they're paying attention now, finally.
Right. And if they ought to drop the pretense with this phony sellout streak. I mean,
a lot of teams do that, though.
Well, I know, but nobody can, but it's so stupid. The Red Sox give out baseballs for the 600th straight sellout. Everybody knows it's the phoniest thing in the world. And there's not a person on the earth who, I'm not going to be bouncing my grandkids on my knee talking about I was alive during the Portland Trailblazers sellout streak from 1977 to 92 or whatever. I didn't know who had the record. Nobody cares about that.
No, that one person.
Like maybe like at a marketing convention, like they all get together and like ooh and ah about the guy that ran, you know, was in charge of the marketing campaign for the Portland Trailblazers that sold out games for 20 years in a row or whatever it was. But nobody on earth cares about that. I don't know why the owners care about it. Everybody knows the Red Sox are a tough ticket. They're a super, super popular team. It's expensive to go there, so they can take pride in that. People want to go and pay their money and go there. So to have this sellout streak continue, I don't know what they get out of it.
I remember in the 90s, the Garden, there was some phantom sellout streak that lasted about 2 years longer than it should have. You could see like 2,000 empty seats, you know, whatever. But anyway, all right, Johnny, we'll call you next week.
All right, I'll talk to you.
All right, let's jump over to Ohio. Are you in Ohio, Titus?
I am in Ohio, yes.
On the phone line, Mark Titus, who writes for Grantland, who covers college basketball for us and wrote some very entertaining college columns this year. He did a feature this week about his old teammate from the eighth grade and from Ohio State, Greg Oden, who never really talks to anybody about anything, and had some pretty illuminating quotes in this piece about what happened to him the last 5 years. It made me feel bad for him. It also made me think that he needs to find a team that will kind of take care of him and welcome him and make him part of their family and look out for him and kind of try to rebuild everything that's happened to him. Titus, this came out yesterday. It was great. What kind of feedback have you been getting?
Most people are, it's about what I expected. Like, a lot of people don't know anything about him, you know, so to kind of get inside his head a little bit, people are really enjoying that. It seems... They're kind of surprised at all the stuff that's going on in his life because you hear the name Greg Oden, you immediately think he's a bust, he's injured all the time, and then you just kind of dismiss him and don't really care about what else he has going on. And,
right.
You know, that's why I kind of wanted to do this story, and I think he really wanted to do it too, is because he's got a lot of personal tragedies in his life that people don't know about, and he deals with a lot of demons, having all the expectations that he hasn't lived up to. And, so I think people are glad to have kind of understood him as a person better. And, you know, and then there's the other side of it, the Portland fans who are, you know, upset that he's playing the victim card a little too much and all that. But I think those are just Portland fans that are bitter, didn't work out, and I don't know, haven't really moved on from it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I can see their side to some degree because it did seem like he was making excuses. But at the same time, I didn't feel like he was making excuses. Like,
yeah.
It seemed like he was, you know, out on an island basically in that team, and he gets hurt as a rookie, and now he's in Portland and he's rehabbing, and then, you know, he was talking about how he didn't have that veteran influence, his cousin comes, his Air Force cousin, turns his house into a party house. Now he's drinking all the time. Gets hurt again. Like, as I was reading the feature, I just kept coming back to, like, you know, let's say this was the San Antonio Spurs. You know, a really good organization that looks out for its players. Like, I just can't believe that they would have allowed some of this to happen. Like, I think those were fair criticisms, don't you?
And I think people confuse excuses with reasons. I don't think he was giving excuses. I think he was just giving reasons. Like, he is the first to admit that it's his fault that he, you know, maybe drank too much and that he, his body, he gets hurt and he rushed back from injury. Like, he could have said, no, I don't want to play. I'm not healthy enough. I don't want to get back into practice yet. So he's the first to admit it. He's just we were more or less just giving reasons, like his cousin influenced him into drinking. He's a grown man. He could have very easily said, no, I don't want to do this, but he didn't.
Yeah.
And he's the first to admit it. So I think you say he's making excuses for himself when really we're just like pointing out reasons and the temptations that are presented. And, you know, credit to him for being man enough to, you know, admit his mistakes. And I thought that was kind of surprising too, that he'd be willing to let me talk about his issues with alcohol, because a lot of guys probably would have wanted that kept secret, you know, and he wanted that in there. He wanted people to know his what he had to deal with and all that. So I don't know. I see how Portland fans can be upset that he's making excuses, and I'm obviously biased because I know him really well. But to me, it was more he takes the blame for everything, but he was just kind of saying how he got to this point in his life.
Well, and also, wouldn't you say he's for an athlete, and especially for somebody that, you know, he only spent 1 year in college, and you think of him just as a young kid, but he seems like a really cerebral guy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people are either super perceptive or not that perceptive. To me, it always struck me with him, like over the last few years, it seemed like he was super perceptive about how people perceived him as a bust.
Yeah.
As the, you know, basically the modern day Sam Bowie. Here's Durant's career taking off. Oh, here's Odin. Let's make some jokes about him. And I know I probably made a couple in columns. Like, he was an easy target. He was like this generation's bus guy. And I think I just feel like he could feel all that stuff. And I think that affected him too, right?
Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, I think that more than anything is why he rushed back from, that was kind of the theme of the feature that I wrote, was that, like, he kept rushing back from these injuries. And, you know, I suggested that maybe Portland was rushing him back, or maybe their medical staff was saying something, but I think more than anything else was probably just him, you know, hearing all these things that people are comparing him to Sam Bowie, that he's a bust, that he's letting down Portland and all this stuff. And knowing him, he feels pressure, and that gets to him. And I'm sure that played a big part in him, you know, wanting to prove that he's tough and prove that he can play through injuries and all that kind of stuff and come back before he's probably ready.
And the other piece that you mentioned in the piece, it could have even really been its own piece, was you have this Portland, the city of Portland, that has one professional team, and they care about the Blazers. I always call them like the soccer moms, you know, lovingly.
Yeah.
Like, they're just so over the top. I mean, I went on the Blazers edge board yesterday, and your feature had been up for 4 hours, and there's 375 comments under whatever the link was already. But so you have this rabid fan base that all they do is just dissect every possible thing that's happening with this team. And then on top of that, you have the history of their centers and Larue Martin and Sam Bowie and Arvydas Sabonis, he got hurt, and Bill Walton, you know, they not only won the 77 title, but the next year's team was better, and that should have been the league's next dynasty, and his feet fall apart, he ends up leaving. And it just seemed like Odin kind of was the natural successor to all that kind of heartache. And man, it's just, when you think about it, you mentioned in the column, it was 5% odds that Portland gets that pick. If he goes to Seattle, which then eventually becomes Oklahoma City, but the organization they had, if he goes to the Celtics, if he goes to, I forget who had.
Yeah, I forget who the worst team was that year that was supposed to have the best chance.
Oh, it was the Celtics. I haven't forgotten. Oh, yeah, it was the Boston Celtics. We had like 25% chance that year to win one of those two guys. And Portland got him with the 5%. But, I think, what team did Memphis was in there. who knows? I mean,
the
it was
had
a crapshoot.
Yeah.
Hawks had third pick, but it really does seem like he went to the worst possible team, considering the baggage that they had and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just bad. It makes it made me sad, the whole piece. I got to be honest.
Yeah, the thing I think about that is that the fans, and rightfully so. I mean, I'm a fan. You're a fan, and we are passionate about our teams and all that. But it's hard to like understand that Greg Oden had nothing to do with Bill Walton or Sam Bowie or you know Sabonis or Larry Martin. He's his own case, you know. And it's easy to say, oh man, it sucks for us Portland fans. We have all these injuries and all that. But for Greg, it's like he feels bad that he's not playing, but like he can't do anything about Sam Bowie. So like, what is he supposed to, you know, like?
Right.
He had nothing to do with that. So I don't know, but that definitely gets to him. And I think it was just a terrible situation for him for all the reasons you mentioned. I mean, the pressure of being the number one pick in and of itself is a big deal, and then having to sit out his whole first year. I mean, Blake Griffin sitting out the Clippers, I'm sure was a big deal that first year. In Portland, it's even. I think everyone expects the Clippers to be awful. But Portland is, you know, we're good, and then we have bad luck. So that just, the whole situation was awful, and I don't know. I can't imagine being in his shoes, and I'm glad I'm not. He's definitely not in an enviable position at all.
And then
the fact how big his genitals are and all the money.
Right. Well, you pointed out, and I don't think that's something that people really. The two things that struck me about this piece that I don't think people had really either thought about or knew about was one, that he had an alcohol problem during his second season, which kind of was out there, but he had never talked about it, so nobody knew how bad it was. And then the effect that the internet photos had on him, which you could have guessed if you knew anything about him, but to hear him say, like, he was afraid to leave his house. That took that whole thing to a whole other level. It made you think, like, man, this guy, his whole world was caving in on him. And then on top of that, he's trying to come back and he keeps breaking down. I don't know. It's just, you know.
I like his logic, too, with the pictures. What he said, like, when a girl's sending me 100 pictures, I have to send her something back. And when he said that, I looked at him, I was like, you know what? That makes sense. Like, I understand that, actually. And then, like, when the pictures came out, I was like, what is he doing? What an idiot. Why would you do that? And all the. And then he's telling me, he's like, listen, when a girl sends me 100 pics of naked, I got to send something back, right? And I'm like, you know what?
I said, I'm not an a-hole. Right.
Yeah. That makes sense, right?
The big takeaway that I guess could be, which will probably end up being a news story coming out of the story, is just whether Portland did him a disservice or not, rushing him back. The piece you had in there about Greg had a psychologist that was talking to him after the internet thing. Suddenly that guy's working on a team. And you know, I think the part to remember here is that the Portland organization was pretty screwed up these last 5 years. You know, they fired Kevin Pritchard and Tom Penn out of nowhere. They hired Rich Cho. They fired him after a year. Last year, they didn't even really have a GM. They had an acting GM. Now they're looking for a GM. And every, you know, people don't even – normally when a GM job is open, people jump at it. And in this case, people are afraid to even talk with them because the feeling is that owner Paul Allen has kind of lost his marbles a little bit, that the people running, you know, Larry Miller and these people running the team are just haven't really run the team that well. And then I was thinking about how Brandon Roy, when he was battling all his knee injuries and knee problems, all that stuff, and they rushed him back. I think it was the 2010 playoffs. And I remember writing about it at the time. It's not something you do if you have a strong organization. They weren't going to win the title that year. Why are you risking Brandon Roy's career and rushing him back early from this torn meniscus? And that made me think there was some real validity to Greg saying he felt pressure to come back. Like, I just feel like if you have a good organization, you're going to baby Greg Oden as much as you possibly can, and you're not putting him on the court until you're 100% sure that he's ready. And I don't feel like they did that.
Yeah, that's what I kind of wanted to bring up in the piece, was that, like, I didn't necessarily – it kind of got taken maybe the wrong way that I was – definitely blaming the Blazers, but I was just bringing that up. Like you said, they just have a history of that, of being, you know, maybe not run as well as they should, and then they have no GM. Do they even have a coach right now?
No coach.
No coach, no GM. I mean, and then the Roy situation, their history of injuries, like Joel Prisbilla's had knee problems too, and what, this year they're the three best players, Roy, Oden, and Aldridge, all had season-ending injuries. You know, heading into the year, it looked like all three of them might have a chance of playing together, and then before the end of the year, they're all out for the year. So, I don't know. There's just a lot of stuff like that. It's like, I mean, it's easy as a fan to just say, oh, we're cursed, and throw your hands up and say, we'll never be good, we're cursed. But then as a neutral, looking at the situation, you're like, not that many bad things and can happen to one franchise. There must be something to this, you know? And I don't know what that something is. I was just throwing it out there that, like, you know, there's got to be something to this. And, you know, Greg is a grown man, like I keep saying. He could have made his own decision and said, no, I don't want to do this. But at the same time, there's a history there, and it's hard to ignore.
And also, I know for a fact from the people that I talked to within the league, like, you know, teams will target sometimes players in other teams that have had injury histories if they feel like that guy's team, either their medical staff isn't great or they screwed some stuff up. Like, it's something where it is talked about. Like, oh, we should go after that guy. They keep screwing things up with him. And if we get him on our team, our doctor, like Phoenix is a team that's famously done that with different people. And it made me wonder, like I read this piece just as a Celtics fan thinking, man, we should roll the dice with this guy. We should just give him.
Yeah,
I know he said in the piece, like, he didn't want money next year, but screw that. Like, sign him a contract. Take him on your team. Bring him into your family. Have your doctors work on him. Just give him some sort of foundation and just take the risk, because we know what he can do when he's healthy.
Yeah. That's funny, because that's, like, the big feedback from everyone who read it. I've heard from probably at least one fan from every fan base in the NBA. Saying that exact thing, like, man, I hope he comes to the Timberwolves or the Knicks or the Suns or the Heat. You know, we'd love to have him, and our doctors could make it work and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, even if he's half as good as what he was when he was healthy, he'd still be pretty good, you know. Like, all you really need, I want to see him go to Phoenix, like you mentioned, for the reasons. I think Indiana would be great for him, being in his hometown. He's very much like a like you said, he's cerebral, and he likes to be in a comfortable position where there's a lot of comfort, having his family there and people that love him. He's loved in Indiana and Ohio and the Midwest. I think that'd be great for him. And also, I kind of want to see him go to Miami, just because he would have to do nothing on the team. You know, he'd be the fourth option, and all he'd have to do is block shots and rebound, which he's great at doing. So, I think he gets in a good situation, and there's certainly teams that are going to take chances on him. He said he got a lot of offers actually after Portland cut him, and he just turned everyone down because he wanted to get healthy. So there's certainly going to be interest when he's ready to get back in, and I just hope it works out for him.
Well, I personally think it should be one of three teams. I don't know if Indiana is a great idea. I don't know if it's a great idea to come home. I know there would be benefits, and maybe psychologically that would help him, but there's also – to me, and I might be wrong, but it seems like the three teams that make the most sense are Oklahoma City, San Antonio, and Boston. Because you want to go to a team that, he wants to go to a team that, a really good organization, a team that has either veterans or real character guys that will really look out for him, a great coach, which Doc and Popovich, I think, would really be able to help him. And then also, he wants to be in a situation where the team's good anyway. I don't, where it's like a luxury if it works out with him, you know, and he's just like, think of him on San Antonio. That team's going to win 60 games next year, regardless of whether they sign him or not. So now he's there with Duncan and Popovich, and, you know, and they're just like, Greg, we don't care if you play this year. Just be a, you know, embrace our culture, work out with us. Just kind of be on a real team for once. And I don't know. I think that would work.
I think not having that pressure of trying to be a franchise savior or something would definitely do him well. But I don't know. He's very much a guy who would succumb. The pressure gets to him, like we keep saying. So, all three of those sound great. He definitely needs to get in a situation, though, where he's not the man. He's not expected to carry the franchise and be the guy that's going to save anything, you know. Like, and it'd be interesting, I think, to see him play with Durant. That'd be kind of funny how everything kind of ends up like that. That'd be fun to watch, see those guys play together after everyone comparing them for so long. And then what if Durant, that's the first title Durant wins is with Greg. And, you know, whose title does that become if Greg is playing well and stuff? So that'd be a little debate, but that'd be fun.
If you were going to rank the – the best stories for what his comeback would be, I think Oklahoma City would be first. And him entering the same team. And just that would just be incredible. I think him ending up in Boston would be really interesting because, you know, he was really the first guy in a long time that was compared to Bill Russell. The Celtics had the best chance to win him that year and didn't. And also like him playing with KG and Pierce, like I think that would be good for him. And the San Antonio, would be interesting. Indiana coming home would be, you know, that's the sports movie ending.
You know?
Or like if we're doing a 30 for 30 about this, that would be the perfect last 15 minutes of the 30 for 30, him redeeming himself in Indiana. So I don't know. I really,
nice. Indiana, I think as good as the Pacers are, he would definitely still be kind of like a savior to the franchise, you know, like.
Yeah, that's not
the
good.
The Pacers they're the three seeds right now. They're in the playoffs doing well and all that, but yet there's not a ton of interest in Indy about them. And if he came to the Pacers, he would be beloved and there would kind of be a lot of pressure for him to be, you know, the star that puts Indiana professional basketball back on the map and kind of, and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know if that'd be great for him, but just having the, you know, the little circle of family and friends that he's comfortable with, would probably do him well, but I don't know.
Well, Miami would be good from the standpoint of now you're getting no attention at all. Just do your thing under the radar because LeBron and Wade will take care of the attention thing. I hope it works out for him. He read the piece, right?
Yeah, he read it. I talked to him last night. He was really excited about it. I think he's just happy that there are people talking about him on the internet without calling him a bust and making fun of him and all that kind of stuff. So that's a first. He told me at one point, I asked him if he has why he doesn't have a Twitter account, and he said, if I had Twitter, it would be the saddest Twitter. I would have the saddest reply feed in the history of Twitter. It would just be people hating on me. And he kind of said that half jokingly, but at the same time, you kind of fell for him. So he's definitely on the internet, like reading stuff that's written about him and all that kind of stuff. So it's gotten to him a little bit. And I think he's finally excited that people understand his story and understand that he's a human. And just because he has millions of dollars and, you know, he's got women throwing themselves at him and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't mean he's got a life to be jealous of, you know. He still has trouble walking when he's rehabbing his knees and all that, just trying to get out of bed every day with a surgically repaired knee, even if you're not even a basketball player, just any job, you know, would be difficult. So,
right.
I don't know. He was pretty pleased with it, though. He's glad that people get inside his head a little bit and kind of understand what he's had going on for 5 years.
We left out one team that would be good for him, the Lakers, because he could go back and forth to Germany with Kobe. And maybe that would save his career. He could be in the private plane, Berlin Airlines or whatever Kobe flies as he's going back and forth for treatments. Hey, great job with that piece. We're really proud of it. I think a lot of people had the same reaction. It was something you either just thought of Odin as a bust or you didn't think of him at all. And now I feel like I'll be rooting for him wherever he goes. Not that I wouldn't have before, but I really hope that he finds the right team and that this works out. Anyway, let's quickly plug your book.
All right.
Came out 2 months ago and it did very well about your Ohio State experiences as a bench warmer. What was the title? Don't Put Me In, Coach?
Don't Put Me In, Coach. Yeah, that was the title of the book. Yeah.
Hey, BS Report people, you should buy this book. It's funny. You'll like it. I really enjoyed it.
It is funny.
I thought it was good.
People are going to be shy. If you read the Odin piece and you expected the book to be like that, don't, because it's not quite that serious and hard-hitting. It's a fun book. It's a good book. So.
All right, good. Yeah, and you got and people bought it and stuff. That was fun.
It's doing well. It sold certainly more copies than what I expected. Yeah, that's for sure.
Now you have to come up with another idea.
I don't know.
Sequel.
I need to get on an NBA team. Me and Greg need to tell people that we're a package deal and get me on an NBA team. Let me warm the bench and I could write another book about my NBA experience.
I like that idea. Trust me, you could not have done more sitting on the Celtics bench than Sasha Pavlovic did for the first 2 months of the season. So I feel like
Scalabrine kind of has the bench warming NBA market corner now that Morris is out of the league. So.
That's true.
He needs some competition. I think he's getting stale with his routine there. He doesn't have any competition in the bench warming game anymore. So like, I need to get a spot somewhere and push him to be better than what he's been since Morrison left.
All right. We will read you on Grantland. Good luck. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
last thing, I wanted to call my dad, who doesn't know that Bill Kennedy is reffing tonight's Game 6 Celtics-Hawks game. I'm going to break the news to him. It's going to be funny, I think.
Hello?
Dad.
Hi, Bill.
You're on the podcast.
I'm on the podcast.
I have some news to break to you.
What is that?
The referees for tonight's Game 6 Celtics-Hawks series.
It's not Mark again, is it? Mark Davis?
No. It's an old foe. Bill Kennedy, one of your favorites.
Well, anybody other than Mark Davis at this point, he seems to either be incompetent or really have some old agenda against the Celtics. So, Bill Kennedy.
Wow. You're putting Mark Davis ahead of Bill Kennedy?
I am, actually.
Oh, my God. Bill Kennedy got fined for how terrible he was to us in 2009.
I'm hoping that he remembers that when he referees tonight.
I can't believe that they put either of those guys in this game. Although I guess in Game 7 it would have been worse. But
you know, on every one of these three-member teams, all season long, there seems to be one person that just can't carry his weight or has some agenda, old-time agenda against certain teams. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, and important note to the listeners out there, we're not biased at all here. But
no, we're not biased at all, and I'm still not upset with Jake O'Donnell from 30 years ago, but that's another story.
Or Earl Strom in Game 4 of the 1987 Finals,
well,
when you didn't get a call for five straight minutes.
I certainly don't have the animosity that somebody like a Mark Cuban justifiably has against certain referees, but memories certainly stick with you about referees over the years.
Well, the Mark Davis thing was amazing because he had just screwed us over the week before over and over again in that Hawks game, and then they put him in charge of the first Hawks game.
It made no sense at all. Yeah.
No.
That's exactly what most people in Boston were wondering. You know, why would you schedule that referee after what had just happened a week before?
Yeah. Well, I think there doesn't seem like they have enough referees because I think Scott Foster has officiated like every day, it seems like. It seems like every game I watch, he's one of the three refs.
Well, you and I have been to enough games where we've said it to each other often enough. You just want to walk out of a game not feeling that you even remembered who the referees were for either team. You just don't want the referee to try to be a factor in the game.
Yeah. It felt like in game one, the reffing was a factor. And, you know, it seemed like we had the series. And then the Pierce knee injury, he just wasn't himself in game five.
No, he had no lift at all. And actually, I thought game five was a fairly well-refed
game. Yeah, that was
a game. You know, when the game was over, we lost. But not for a moment did I think of any play that the referee had influenced at all. So that's all you're looking for.
I thought it was a legitimate loss. Atlanta played better. And then the fact that Rondo had that steal at the end, and then I'll never understand why he dribbled left instead of right. Nothing good happens going left. You go to the middle. You always go to the middle in that play. And he just went left for some reason. And
you might not have noticed it, but in the Boston paper, for one of the first times, even Doc Rivers was very open about saying he didn't understand why Rondo didn't dribble to the right, that you always go to the middle in a situation like that. You never hear Rivers at all publicly criticize Rondo. So,
yeah. I wonder with that play, like knowing about the history with Rondo and Josh Smith and how, you know, how close they were and they played in high school together and their buddies, like it almost made me wonder if whatever Rondo was trying to do would have worked against anybody else. But since Josh Smith probably knows everything he's going to do, he kind of sniffed it out and was like, oh, I'll just force him this way. He won't be able to do anything.
Well, I think it's a good point. I think, you know, they were roommates. They were in each other's weddings, from what I understand.
He's going to be in our team. We already have a jersey ready for him, Josh Smith. When are we getting him?
You know, he's one of those players that, while he's on the other team, you always have a criticism of him. But if he's on your team, he leaps out of the building like no other man on the court. So I'll take him.
Yeah. I actually think he could potentially lead to at least one heart attack for you.
I'm a little worried about, you know, for the first three games, we were really playing five against four because their center was not a factor at all. I thought Horford was the difference in the game Tuesday night, and it worries me that he could also be a difference maker tonight. So hopefully,
yeah, he had a lot of energy. He had a lot of energy in that game five.
He kept balls alive. He was making the pick and roll. He was making the little jump shot, although it's not quite a jump shot. He doesn't seem to leave his feet, but it goes in. Little worried.
What worries me about this game is that normally you would say, I think Pierce has reached a level, at least in my head, where you just go, oh, Pierce will take care of things tonight. You know, it's almost like game two, or we knew Pierce was going to show up in game two. I don't know if they were going to win, but I knew Pierce was going to have a great game. And if he was healthy, I would go into this game thinking, great crowd, Pierce will take care of business, Rondo will have a triple-double, we win. But Pierce just didn't look right in game five. And, like, that air ball, I don't think I've ever seen him air ball that last-minute shot. Do you ever remember him airballing that shot?
No, not a mid-range jumper. That's his bread-and-butter shot. But I think I mentioned to you in the paper, they had a picture of Joe Johnson defending him. And to give Johnson his due, he was defending him very well and actually almost blocked that ball. So I think Pierce, in an attempt to get over Johnson's outstretched fingers, just didn't have the right accuracy in terms of height. But you probably didn't see the interview before the game. Pierce was honest enough to say that he felt better, but he couldn't move laterally. And that really hurts us when he's not at 100%.
Well, plus he defends Joe Johnson.
You noticed Pierce sat a lot at the end of the third into the fourth, and they had other guys defending Joe Johnson. So they tried to take some of the pressure off of Pierce defense-wise. But he had no lift. He had no lift at all.
What are you expecting from you've been a season ticket holder since 1974. What are you expecting from a Thursday night 8 p.m. Game 6 locked-in Boston crowd? Like, in the old days, this would be a monster crowd. It still feels like the crowd can get there. I'm feeling like this will be a great crowd tonight.
I think it's going to be a great crowd. It was a great crowd at home the other night, a terrific crowd. That was a Sunday night. It looked like people had been in the establishments around the garden all afternoon.
We like that.
An 8 o'clock game start tonight. People get out of work around 5. They have all those places that you've gone to many times. Of course, I've never frequented them, and I think people are going to be pumped up for the game tonight. I think we're going to win tonight. I'm looking for the good Rondo to show up, not the Rondo who seems to be unwilling to go to the basket. I think at home he plays differently, and I think we're going to win.
I think worst case scenario is one of those Rondo games where I think he'll have a huge game, but when he has those games where he puts up the triple-double but he still missed 8 shots from 5 feet and in,
right?
That's the game that would kill us tonight. Because he'll have those from time to time where he just can't make a shot.
What really worried me, and I'm sure you noticed it Tuesday night, Rondo took our first 3 shots. He missed all 3 of them, but it somewhat set the tone that, first of all, you don't want him taking the first 3 shots of the game when we have shooters out there. And when he missed them all, you know what he's like in terms of his confidence.
Yeah.
He seemed to lose it, and his shooting percentage was poor. He never really got into the game offensively, and he seemed to be afraid to go into the middle. So I don't want him taking the first 3 shots. Penetrating and going out. Bradley's hurt, too. You might have noticed.
Yeah, Bradley's hurt. I don't think he's been the same either. That one worries me because I think he would have played with a lot of energy.
I think he would have. I think he, particularly defensively, could have helped us. They said they strapped him with a harness to see if it would help with his left shoulder, and he said he couldn't move with it. So that tells you that it really is a factor right now.
If they somehow make it to round two, and if the Bulls somehow hang on, and it's Celtics, the banged-up Celtics against the even more banged-up Bulls. That would be a really interesting series, especially from what I'm hearing, not confirmed yet, but if Chicago goes to a game seven or Boston goes to a game seven, the next round will go Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, the first four games. So whoever has games three and four at home will be back to back. And man, if Philly ends up winning that series in seven or whatever, and the Celtics have to go to Philly in round two, hypothetically, if we make it, and those game three and four back to back in 24 hours, that's going to be brutal.
It's going to be brutal. I hadn't heard that. That worries me for even a different factor. They interviewed Ray Allen, and he said, you know, one reason he's been able to play this series is there's no back-to-backs. He doesn't know if he could even go back-to-back. So I think that certainly affects an older team, and of all the teams out there, we're certainly probably the most veteran team left.
One good thing for tonight, the J-Bug, I think, is going to be in the house tonight. So the crowd will be about 8% better. Yeah, the J-Bug can single-handedly turn the building around.
Hopefully he makes it from whatever establishment he starts his evening over to the Garden.
He will be well-established by the time he arrives in the arena.
I will look for him at the Garden. Actually, I will try to listen for his sound, as he has a unique sound in the Garden.
Hopefully he will keep his shirt on. All right, root for the Celtics tonight. Good luck. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, talk to you. Bye.
Target to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.